Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
No growth without pain, but leaders don't want to embrace the pain. One thing that they ask me, I'm a little bit peculiar how I deal with my clients, but one of the things that people, when we're starting the first steps of an engagement, say, well, what does success look like? And of course, they expect people are going to do this, productivity. And I say, success looks like if when the executive team redefine their culture, at least one team member quits. And they say, what? I don't want my people to quit. Well, I say, your team, no team is perfectly aligned, and you don't want people to be 100% aligned because we're human beings. But if through the process, we always uncover there's a lot of people that are not completely off where you want to achieve as an organization. And if this process doesn't reject those people that are not into it, then we haven't done a good job.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing very good, very good. I'm pretty excited. It's November. Well, I mean, we are going to launch this episode later on, but
yeah,
today, yeah, today is November, and it's the November the 3rd, and I'm very happy about it. I am already thinking about Christmas, so that's
good. Yeah, it's a nice time of year, definitely. Yeah. So we have talked a lot before in the Scaling Tech Podcast about remote teams, both from our own experience over the last decade of leading Agility Feet, as well as tapping into the experience of our guests with remote technical teams. In today's episode, we'll speak with author Gustavo Rossetti about how to have remote teams that are not distant. And I really liked his emphasis on intentional culture in remote teams and how important that, I think it's really important for tech leaders to think about. As we discuss with them, we're often so busy just trying to get our systems to work that we don't necessarily pay attention to the culture we're building in our teams, intentionally or unintentionally. I liked how he defined culture as things that we both reward and punish, again, intentionally or unintentionally, and how culture is an amplifier. You know, it's not going to solve anything by itself, but it's definitely an amplifier of things, good or bad, in our teams. What did you find interesting about this conversation?
Well, right from the start, you will see me just puzzled by something. Is for the first time, I am questioning myself, what is the real meaning of the word culture? And why right. We are so in love with it. And Gustavo made a very good point. Is now one of these fancy words that you find in LinkedIn. It's so important now. But
right.
Why? What is the real meaning? So we go deep on that, and I think you guys will enjoy this episode.
Be
very interesting. Yeah,
I agree completely. All right. Well, let's get to our interview with Gustavo Rossetti. Gustavo Rossetti is the CEO of Fearless Culture and author of Remote Not Distant. One of the world's leading workplace culture thinkers, he's helped leaders and teams at Fortune 500, startups, nonprofits, and everything in between all around the world. His work has been featured in the New York Times, BBC, Psychology Today, Forbes, and Fortune. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Gustavo.
Thank you, guys. Very excited to be here and looking forward to an interesting conversation.
Absolutely. No, it's wonderful to have you here. Really have been looking forward to this conversation. I picked up a copy of your book. It was beach reading for me a few months ago, and really some great stuff in there. So I was excited to for us all to have the chance to speak. Can we start a little bit with a little bit about your background? How did you get interested in workplace culture and in particular the future of remote work?
That's a great question. I was during my vacation reflecting on my past 5 years running my company when I started from scratch. And my background is on marketing and innovation, right? And when I decided to work on or move towards the culture field, a lot of people say, but you don't know anything about it. Who are you? What's your expertise? So they challenged my credentials. And that's not the first time that happened in my career. But on one hand, I realized that I have a lot of experience because as a former CEO and also as a consultant, while working with teams, trying to help them become more innovative, to come up with better ideas, I realized that actually most companies have much better talent, much more better ideas and resources than they think they have. The issue is that the culture doesn't let those ideas see the light of day. Basically, perfectionism, criticism, fear overall gets in the way, and then most ideas, most innovative ideas get killed, or people's potential gets reduced to maybe one third or one half of what they actually could deliver. So that's basically what triggered me. And also the quest of people saying, you don't know what you're talking about. I say, well, then if I succeeded in other backgrounds, other careers, I'm going to make my way here. And here I am.
Excellent. And were you doing much with remote teams prior to the pandemic? When did you start to see remote work becoming more prevalent with your clients?
That's a good point. I mean, I was guilty of thinking, we need an office for building culture. And I always saw remote work more like a perk or an exception. And I started doing a lot of, because my audience, because of my writing, it's global. So in some cases, people couldn't pay me or my team to fly to Australia, some other place. So we started doing things remotely. So we're almost ready for that. But not at the scale when the pandemic started. Actually, I was on right about in March to kick off a tour, and I was going to visit like many cities in the US, Canada, many countries in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, to run a program. And I had to cancel everything and turn it online, and also convince people to, hey, I don't want to pay everybody. You can stay. We can run it. People that never have used some, even Zoom or Mural or other tools that we use online. So it was a great acceleration for me to really rethink how to keep the other, because it's not just about copy-pasting what I was doing in person, but changing completely the structure, the dynamics, how to involve people, how to use breakout rooms with intentionality and many other stuff, and breaks. No? So it was really powerful in that sense. Yeah. And now we're on the other side of the spectrum where people say, hey, let's come here. We need to do this offsite in person. I say, well, we can get the best results doing it virtual, because that's what we've been seeing, that doing remote stuff, we're getting better results than when we get in the same room with people.
Now, something that you mentioned before is been stuck in my head since. You mentioned something interesting, and you mentioned it frequently in your book. It's about culture. Mm-hmm. So can we define that? I mean, is one of those terms that are sometimes sort of floating in people's head. So what is culture, and why is it so important in this conversation?
That's a great question. I mean, there's a saying that people tend to repeat, because on LinkedIn and other stuff, if you repeat, we need to adopt that growth mindset. We need to be agile. You're on.
Right.
So people tend to say that culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? And they attribute that quote to Peter Drucker, even though no one has found a record that he said it, but who cares, right? The point is, culture is very important, but culture alone doesn't work. So culture is an amplifier. If you as a startup or engineering team, you lack a proper strategy or the right product, your culture is not going to solve for that. However, you have the right product, the right team, the right process, well, culture can accelerate that. So culture, to your point, David, it's conveniently fluffy because people don't know what they're talking about. So they say, no, culture matters. For some people, culture is impromptu conversations in the water cooler. For others, it's perks. Let's give them free sushi and ping pong tables, and that's our culture. Mm-hmm. In the end, when I started my work, one of the challenges I had, as I mentioned, people say, well, what's your expertise? So I started applying my human-centered design experience into how can we create conversations around culture to make it more tangible. That's why I developed a tool called the Culture Design Canvas. So similar, many people from my audience are familiar with Alex Osterwalder's business model canvas that helped a lot of organizations to be more intentional about the business model. I decided to do the same for culture. And so I identified through research three key elements of culture and are captured in the canvas. At the center of the culture is what drives the foundation, that core that includes the purpose, the values, and behaviors, which basically are the structure. If you're building a house and you don't have a good structure, a good foundation, everything's going to collapse. So that's the core of the culture. So it's basically your vision for where you want to take your company in the future. Then there's an emotional side of culture, which is the glue that brings people together, the sense of belonging. Sometimes people see only that side, and that's psychological safety, feedback, team rituals. So how we create that emotional glue that connects people. And lastly, we use the term agility, not from an agile perspective, although there's an overlap, but more for how can what side of culture helps your company move fast, adapt, and be resilient. And that has to do with how we make decisions as a team, how we meet. I mean, meeting in a collaboration standpoint, including both asynchronous, asynchronous, and lastly, norms and rules. So in the end, for us, culture is the way we do things, so how we operate, but also the way we think, our mindset, and the way we feel, the emotional side of a culture.
Very nice. And I think, and the phrase you use in the book, I believe, is culture by chance, moving from culture by chance to culture by design. And I think that's a powerful statement there of how you have to be intentional about your culture. And I think for our listeners who tend to be engineering leaders and they're focused very much on delivering product and reducing defects in software and, you know, very technical, tangible things like that, culture is something that they're maybe not thinking as intentionally about. How do you move from culture by chance to culture by design?
Yeah, the culture of a company happens or a team happens even if you're not intentional about it. So some things that are organic can be good, but in most of the cases, the companies that have been really successful are those that have been very intentional about building their culture. So in the startup and tech world, we hear things like, hey, we need to be more experimental. We need to be more innovative. We need to be more agile. We need to take more risk, etc. Well, those are like, it feels more like intentions or it feels more like an outcome. But what's the culture? So for example, we talk that the culture is the behaviors that we reward and punish. So if I make a mistake as a team member and then I'm going to be blamed, if I'm going to be put on the spot or actually punished for that, then I'm not going to be willing to take those risks in the future. So the culture is how, for example, how do we deal with fear? How do we deal with mistakes? So I have a tool that I use with team, which is how to run a blameless postmortem. So we screw up. A project, we have an incident, a client I was working with, cannot name it, but they were presenting to their CEO, the CEO was presenting their new budget and talking to all the global heads of a large, very large company, and wow, the tech team had put a new technology in place, and voila, it didn't work when the CEO was about to speak to the whole leadership of the company, right? So what started is the fear that caused, rather than people say, okay, we screw up, how can we fix it? They create an even bigger problem because the way they reacted to it, reacted with even more fear. And rather than fixing the problem, it became even worse and worse. So they had to cancel the meeting.
I like that phrase a lot, the blameless postmortem, and certainly in agile methodologies, we talk about retrospectives at the end of a scrum sprint and how to keep those and the importance of those being blame free. How do you balance that? I mean, if you have, say, a technical team that just did a big release to production, hopefully not too big if they're an agile team, but they did a release to production, it didn't go well, there were lots of defects, they've been cleaning up afterwards, you know, how do you work through something like that in a blameless way?
The important thing, starting from a broader picture, is that the culture, as we've been talking about, and going back to David's question, culture is a system, right? And usually when something goes wrong in a company, people look at the individual. So who screwed up? Rather than what in the system allow people to do that mistake or encourage people to think that that was the right decision or encourage people to take a shortcut. Because sometimes we say, hey, we need to do great QA, but also we say, hey, we need to deliver this faster because of investors' pressure. We need to show up them so we get more money, you know, and then we cut corners and then we screw up. So I think the biggest important thing is focus on the system. That doesn't mean that some people are going to screw up, but usually companies penalize the many for the mistakes of a few. So basically one person screw up and then they create a rule and everyone's going to get like a punish for that. There are things moving from I to you, no? So the conversations, usually when we say, I had to do the quality assessment, but then you bring your part to me too late in the game. If I say you did it, then it becomes blame rather than because someone sent the software that I need to review too late in the game, I wasn't able to go through the whole process as accurately I should have. So then you start saying, okay, what happened in the system? You go back to the process, you go back to behaviors, you move from emotions, you move away from people and try to focus on, okay, what can we fix moving forward? No? So I think the relationship with blame also has to do with the leader of the team. No? So as a leader, when your team screw up, are you encouraging them with questions to try to uncover? No? Do you promote curiosity or do you promote finger pointing? And that's kind of the culture that the leader set.
Yeah, it absolutely has to be set by the leaders. Certainly completely agree. And I think one thing I've heard people talk about to help with that too is in whether it's the Scrum Master, whoever's say facilitating a retrospective, to be able to say if someone does start to say, well, you delivered that, you know, too late to me, you're kind of reframing the conversation. Hey, let's talk about the system. Like you just said, Gustavo, let's talk about the process. Let's focus on that. And having kind of a rule within those meetings that if there are, because sometimes there are individual contributors on the team who maybe are, you know, regularly causing problems for delivery, that is more like a personnel issue, a human resources issue, something that's not dealt with in that meeting, right? And we only talk about the system.
I think I can give an example of when the better approach is to think systematically about a problem. The other day I was talking with a team, a software development team, and how I was talking with a team leader. I'm not sure if that person is Scrum Master. I mean, exactly what is the position they have? He has, and he was complaining that. The structure they have for the sprints is that they do the demo at the end of Friday. And for some reason, they do planning Monday morning. However, because they work with a remote team, morning for him is not the same for the rest of the team. So what happens is that he was complaining that he was experiencing some slack from the developers because the developers were lazy the morning before the planning. Mm-hmm. They had some time that they weren't making any use, any productivity effort. And the first thing I told him is, well, I mean, you could argue that the developers are lacking some initiative. You could argue that. But if you think about it, what is actually happening is that if you had the planning on Friday as the last thing of the Friday, then you will kill the problem immediately. Because now on Monday morning, now everybody knows what to do for the rest. So they were the first. It doesn't matter where they are. By Monday, doesn't matter where they are, they know what to do. And he was thinking, huh, I didn't think about that. So that but then we could, after that, we start talking about the individuals. That definitely were some individuals that were lacking some initiative. And then we could address those things. But when you think in system first, what is the process? What are the things that the process are encouraging to happen? And you will notice that many things can be improved actually by thinking in process first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that what's the intent? No, I think that GitLab has this idea that we always need to assume positive intent. They talk about the the short toes principle. Basically, if everyone has short toes, no one says stepping on your toes, kind of. So when in doubt, to your point, I think that's important. Rather than jump and say, hey, my team is lacking, rather than assume that people have bad intentions, is assume good intentions. So, okay, if people are not doing this, what's going on? To your point, David, and say, okay, maybe we need to change when we release something so people on Monday have clear marching orders rather than rushing out or whatever. No? So, leaders, I mean, I was working with a team, a tech team, actually a global team, a couple of weeks ago. And one thing that happens is we're doing a post-mortem for one of their projects. And this was the senior global leaders. And when they review a huge, huge incident that happened, is everyone started looking for the people, those staff. So the people that were in the room were blamed for everything that happened. So I say, hey, hello. This is like when parents are blaming kids for because they screw up. No, usually kids do something because they mimic their parents' behaviors and models. So we changed the conversation. It was really tough because that's the part about those leaders don't want to get into self-reflection. They usually tend to see what others are doing wrong. But then it became a wow, no? And they came out after a very dramatic, I thought it was going to fire me in the middle of the project because I was pushing them so hard. And they say, well, you need to start changing how we think about the people. And it was really interesting, no? So the methodology per se, whatever methodology you're using, is not going to help your team if you're not changing your mindset as a leader. No, that's the point about culture. No, we're talking about the human element. A culture is not just happiness and getting along together, which is important, but it's more about that human system, no? So that we need to review and it starts with ourselves.
Now I think I'm getting at a very nice definition of culture, because what you're saying is very tied to what Erin and I always talk to ourselves about the values. What are the principles of values? Those concepts that are behind the soul of the company, but the next question is quite important. How do we think those values and principles are manifested? What are the specific actions that we can give as examples where we think, yeah, we are manifesting those principles, those values? What do you think about that? It's how do we manifest those things, those beliefs, those systems, those mental systems in the day-to-day life?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, from a leader standpoint, you need to define the culture that you want, what are the values, your purpose, behaviors. But then it starts by you demonstrating the values before you start demanding, no, that people behave in a particular way. And one thing that happens is we hear companies say, hey, we're very collaborative. And then who gets promoted? The least collaborative manager, one who works alone, doesn't share information, is always backstabbing people. So what people say, we're not collaborative, because people measure or assess the culture in terms of the decisions that the leaders make, not in what they preach in a town hall meeting. No, the same happens. We are a very innovative company, but only the CEO or leader or team leader's ideas are approved, or we don't want to take risks. And the best ideas, the risky ideas, always get killed. So, what do we mean by innovation? No? Everyone's throwing the word there, but is it disruptive innovation, or are we looking for constant improvement across the organization? And also within a company, for the product team, the tech team, innovation might mean something different than it means for marketing or sales or legal team, no? And companies don't do that. I think that's important about culture, understanding not only overall what we stand for, what are our core values, but also how those values affect each subculture. Because each team has a particular subculture, and that subculture serves the larger organization.
One thing that we started doing this year that I really liked, in terms of trying to be a little more intentional about our culture and demonstrating it, was when we revised a set of principles that we wanted our developers to, our team as a whole, to kind of emulate. And in our company meetings, we had previously been doing kind of like shout outs of, you know, hey, you know, you can just call out somebody who's done a great job, and we'll mention that, you know, some public kudos to people. But what we started doing, a little twist on that, was tying them to individual valuables, to values, to principles in the team. So, for example, you know, one that I like is, talk about, we want our team members to be drivers, not passengers. We want them to drive the solutions that they're working on with their clients and not just kind of go along with the flow. And so if someone gets a shout out from one of their colleagues that, you know, they came up with a great idea, then we sort of categorize it. We say, here's some great examples of somebody being a driver instead of a passenger, you know, this month. And so trying to do things like that, to, especially because we're a fully remote team, have been for over a decade. These are things and behaviors that people would not see across, you know, they're not going to see it in the office because we're not there together. But then also, we're a services company. People are working with different clients on different projects, so they may not see things happening outside of their own teams as well. So that's one way we've tried to start to build that that example a little bit more publicly of what are the behaviors and good examples of it. But that is, I think, harder to do in a remote setting than in an office. You know, you can't just put the principles up on the wall. So, you know, what are some other ways that you encourage teams to be intentional about that, to demonstrate that?
That's a good point. I think that actually having the principles or the values on the wall doesn't help, because talk about Enron, no? They have a lot of principles about being good for the community, being transparent, and many other stuff, and then they basically broke all the rules, no? I think that we just worked a couple of months ago with a client, a tech startup. I mean, 1,000 people now, no? So early stage. And they revisited all the values and then the behaviors and leadership principles. And one thing that they did is basically they invited people to reflect on how are you going to bring these values to life. So more on a personal level of your everyday job, how are you going to contributing? Even if you're the admin of someone, some leader there in the company. Another thing that was interesting, they draw a line and say, hey guys, we revisited our values, but we really care about it. So we're going to discuss it, ask all the questions you have, but if you feel that these values don't align with who you are, then we're going to offer you a generous package and you can leave the company. Because if you're not 100% on board, we want to... So that was and this is a fully remote organization. So it was a very dramatic message. It wasn't about these are the values, it's either accept them, embrace them, or go somewhere else. No hurt feelings.
I like that. I like it. Yeah. I mean, why should we be stuck? Why should we be stuck in a place that actually I just discovered I don't agree with their values? And conversely, why a company should keep that person? So it is good. I mean, at the end, we are in a collaborative society. If we don't share the values and we don't like where we are or how we... or the person we are dealing with, we shouldn't be there. I like it.
Absolutely. There's always this idea that there's no growth without pain, but leaders don't want to embrace the pain. One thing that they ask me, I'm a little bit peculiar how I deal with my clients, but one of the things that people, when we're starting the first steps of an engagement, say, well, what does success look like? And of course, they expect people are going to do this, productivity. And I say, success looks like if when the executive team redefine their culture, at least one team member quits. And they say, what? I don't want my people to quit. Well, I say, your team, no team is perfectly aligned, and you don't want people to be 100% aligned because we're human beings. But if through the process, we always uncover there's a lot of people that are not completely off where you want to achieve as an organization. And if this process doesn't reject those people that are not into it, then we haven't done a good job. So it's counterintuitive, because you want people to feel, no, I want my team to be everyone aligned. No, we need to make sure that we exclude the people that are not buying into this dream. And for some people, that feels completely off. And many CEOs say, oh, wow, I haven't thought about it. And they feel, oh, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Now this is taking me mentally to another place. How do you deal with... tell me about your experiences when you are in a company, working with that company, and you realize that there is one person, one element
that is not the right fit for the company. That person maybe is not willing to leave necessarily, but you have discovered that person is not a good fit for the company. How would you go about that?
Yeah, that's a hard part for two reasons. First, because our role is not to assess people individually, right?
Okay, we focus on
the system. When we see something that's worry, we raise a flag. We would never advise our clients to fire someone first because we're not paid to do that. So that we step in beyond our role, and we want to be clear that what are we
Maybe you're not paid enough.
What we observe from an experience dealing with people, it's just one part. We cannot judge an executive because what we observe on a workshop, on a stakeholder interview or survey or whatever they did. When we're not seeing how they lead their team, how they help in the company, their menu. So that's something that their managers need to assess. But of course, if there's something that's really, really off, we always say, hey, look, there's something there. What's going on? You should dig deeper into that. And sometimes people are simply pissed off because they are frustrated. It's not that they don't want to be part of the company. And maybe there's a different type of conversation that needs to happen, which is not just get rid of them.
Sure.
I like the idea of offering that severance package, essentially, because while that might sound expensive at first to executive management, it's generally a lot cheaper than that person hanging on for 6 months or 2 years and disrupting the culture of the team, not buying into things. It's kind of like from a technical practice perspective, I could imagine doing that also if you have a team that is, believes very strongly in pair programming or mob programming or a technical practice that not all developers are necessarily comfortable with, then saying, hey, we're adopting this. And after this sort of trial period, if you don't like it and you don't want to do that, this portion of your time or whatever, then, here's an incentive for you to leave because this is important to us. Right. And I think those sorts of things are definitely powerful statements, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You were mentioning, for example, connecting values to behavior. So I think that giving kudos to people that when they bring their values to life, it's really effective. And you can do that, of course, in a remote or hybrid setting. I always encourage that, try to mostly give collective kudos. If you want people to think as a team, no? I mean, it's John, Jane, but what about the development team, the ops? So try to focus on because that's what we're trying to reward, collective work, not individual heroes. On the other hand, when it comes to feedback, not only on formal performance reviews, but also if we're going to have one-on-ones, if we're going to have a retros or whatever, we always need to connect everything that we're doing back to those values. Now, that's an interesting and easy way to bring those values to life. You can also reflect. We invite people to do a values retrospective, maybe once a quarter, and what things have we accomplished as a company that basically are helping us bring those values to life, and what actions or decisions have we made that maybe are betraying or aren't being as truthful or transparent when it comes to the values that we agreed that we're going to bring to life. So that's a good exercise as well.
Nice. Now, I think you defined a culture earlier. It's a matter of what you reward and what you punish is kind of what defines your culture, if I caught that correctly. So if we're trying to be very careful in sort of like collective rewards to the team and encouragement to the team, how do you handle the punishment side of that? I mean, what's an example of something that you want to be intentional about punishing in order to create a good culture in your team, and how you do that on an individual or collective basis?
Yeah. First, I mean, when we use the word reward and punish, sometimes people get like a little bit, it feels like school, whatever. But the point is, if we use, we tested in the past, encourage and discourage, those feel like an intention. But what we're trying to do is when you reward and you punish, you're acting upon. So you're doing something. You're drawing a line as a leader. And that's very important. So when it comes to punish, the first instance could be, I wouldn't hire someone that would do X, Y, and Z. for example. I could call out when someone does whatever. I would have a one-on-one conversation. At some point, I wouldn't promote this person, or I could fire that person. So it's a escalation kind of a approach. I think that one of the things that companies do is having a no asshole rule. No, I don't care if you're smart as an engineer, but if you're not good, no. Slack, for example, punish people who backstab other colleagues because they don't want that to happen. So that's kind of important. Mm-hmm. Airbnb punishes people that don't leave the mission. So Airbnb encourages their employees that at least once per year they also host someone. So they turn their home into an Airbnb because they want people to experience. And if you are not willing to do that, then they're not going to get you into that. So that's kind of the things that are important. No? If you stand for something, make sure that your decisions are going to align with rewarding what you stand for, but also drawing a line when people don't abide by those values.
Right. Absolutely. So let's talk a little more about psychological safety. You mentioned that. I definitely talk about it in the book, and the extra importance and challenges of developing psychological safety within a remote team.
Yeah, psychological safety is the feeling or belief that your team is safe for taking interpersonal risks. In other words, that you can bring your full self to work, you can ask questions, you can challenge, you can ask for help, you can ask for time off. No, there's a lot of conversations that can happen or come up with ideas that challenge the status quo, and it's going to be okay. There's not going to be any repercussion or a punishment for doing that. One thing that's important is safety doesn't mean protective. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking like it's like building a safety net so you can take risk, you can take the leap, and your team is going to be there holding you. I sometimes refer to it as collective trust. So trust happens between two people. No? So Arin trusts Gustavo, and that's why we're having this conversation, same with David. However, psychological safety is something that the whole team needs to provide. There are three levels. One is at a personal level. I'm unaccepted, so I'm being included as a team. I'm accepted as a person. So there are a lot of activities that we do to create an emotional connection. If I'm not feeling accepted as a team member, I'm going to feel safe to move to the next level, which is having courageous conversation. That's level two. That means that I can speak up my mind, I can ask questions, I can challenge people, and I can think differently. You know? So not only that my opinion is respected, but actually my leader encouraged me to think differently, because we know that the most successful teams are teams that provide psychological safety, but also have cognitive diversity. They have people who have different backgrounds, different experiences, and that combination, is what makes magic come to life. And lastly, we have psychological safety to create a culture of innovation. And going back to our origin of our conversation, you cannot build a culture of innovation if you don't complete level one and level two. So many companies expect people to come up with new ideas, and probably people have those ideas. But if I'm not feeling accepted, if I don't feel safe to speak up, I'm going to keep the ideas to myself. So once again, why I'm working in culture, not because people don't have ideas, it's because we need to create a safe culture in which people can share the ideas they already have, but they're keeping them to themselves because they're afraid of repercussions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so as a for a technical leader, how do you balance when you know, so hopefully we've gotten through the first and the second level of feeling welcomed into the team and being able to ask questions, feeling comfortable, confident in asking those questions within the team. When in the third level, I believe, where we want to be really a culture of innovation, we want to feel like as a technical member of the team, we have the freedom to experiment with new technologies or new ideas of how we could do things and contribute those back to the team. How do you balance that with the team need to also have kind of, you know, like a standard architecture across the team to have some agreement upon the technical decisions that are made? How do you handle that experimentation in a way that encourages it, but also doesn't allow it to potentially be disruptive in an operational sense?
Absolutely. I think that once again, we need to codify what culture means to our company and what innovation it means to our company and what innovation means to a particular team. So if we throw the term, hey, we need to be more innovative, people don't know exactly if it's, I'm going to start breaking things just to show I'm creative.
Right.
For example, when it comes to a legal team, what does innovation mean? Do you want people to start breaking the law so they're cool and creative? So if you're doing QA, are you about to innovate or make sure you are following the process and the software is running?
Right. Smoothly?
So as a team leader, you know, if you're an engineering team leader, you need to be very explicit about what innovation means to your team, but also to the specific functions within the team. Maybe there are some team members that are expected to innovate, but some team members no. Or within a project, in which areas are we willing to take risks and innovate, and which areas we know that how things work and we don't want to break things in the process. So
yeah,
it's about codifying that. No, that's an interesting, basically start with what do we mean by innovation? What does innovation mean for the team? What does it mean for each of the key functions and then individually?
Yeah. There's the famous or infamous statement of culture at Facebook of move fast and break things, right? Which is not necessarily, that is a culture. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a healthy culture or is proven to be a healthy culture. So being very intentional about what does that mean in our case? You know, how do we allow for the creativity? How do we move fast? But how do we also do it in a way that makes sense for the product that we're building, for the, mm-hmm. you know, the application users that we serve, et cetera?
That's one thing that we do that we resolve in the culture canvas with what we call priorities. So we use even our statements, no? We choose things that are really good. We like speed, we love quality, we love innovation, but then we put them, which comes first? No, is it speed even over quality, or is it software quality even over speed?
Right.
So yeah, we want speed, but we're not going to sacrifice speed. We're not going to sacrifice, quality because of speed. No. So those are the things that help you make those decisions. So for example, innovation even over predictability or whatever, but then it's quality even over innovation. So kind of finding those tensions, choosing those things that are really, really good to the company, but make sure people understand when you have to choose between one or the other, I'm not going to sacrifice a quality for speed, for example.
Right. Yeah. And there's not a single right or wrong answer to that balance. It depends on the industry that you're in, that sort of thing. If I'm working on, you know, safety critical healthcare related software, then innovation is important, but quality is more important, right? The patient can't die on the table.
Or data protection. When you're talking about healthcare, you want to make sure that your team protects the health data of all your patients and members. So for sure. And that's very important. It varies per industry and also per company. Some companies are willing to take more risks. And that's okay. We need to find that balance. And that's hard for us as facilitators or consultants to make sure that we're not imposing our standards, but we're helping companies develop the ones that are going to really work for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're starting to come to the end of our time together, but I've really enjoyed this conversation, Gustavo. One thing I want to, if you want to throw out any quick thoughts on this, or I'll certainly encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of your book, Remote Not Distant, and check out the section on 6 modes of collaboration for distributed teams. That was one area I particularly enjoyed. I liked the way that you balanced the discussion of deep work and shallow work and me time and we time and laid out these 6 different modes within that teams need at various times, individuals need at various times. That was a powerful part of the book for me. Very, very interesting read. What other, do you want to add any thoughts onto that? Or what other areas do you want to make sure that we've discussed in this conversation of remote, but not distant?
Well, I think the idea of collaboration is changing. So we have the bias to think that in order to collaborate, we need to collaborate in real time in actually in the same place. And today we're moving towards more of an asynchronous collaboration. Cautious with this is we have people forcing the traditional model, and then people say, no, now everything needs to happen async. It's not one or the other. It's understanding, and once again, it varies per team, when asynchronous works best and where synchronous does that. So for example, when you have an emergency, don't send an email, no, make a phone call. So you need to, when you have a big issue, the team is not aligned, you need to get people in the room. That's going to make it easier. When you're going through a restructure or a discussion that's really, really complex, it's better to have people in real time. But then, even for many decision-making processes, asynchronous works best. It allows people to work in a more reflective, calm manner, to take their time. Everyone can chime in at their own time. They can build off each other rather than rush the process. So that's the magic, no? Asynchronous provide that space, that reflection, that calmness. The synchronous collaboration helps people move faster and talk about things that are more complex. Lastly, one thing that's important when you mention the modes of communication and collaboration, it's most teams spend 80% of their time doing day-to-day tasks rather than thinking and developing things that require a deep thinking. So I think that we need to switch that, ideally 80 deep thinking and 20 taking care of the minutiae, no? Less emails, less churning stuff rather than doing work that actually is going to create an impact. And that's about minimizing interruptions. So protecting people, either the team or the individual time to do that work and make it okay. Many companies say, hey, we have no meeting Fridays, but then everyone's calling for a meeting. People are encouraged to protect their time, but then their CEO or team leader sends them an invite or calls them and interrupt that flow time. So that's kind of important, not only to talk about it, but protect that time for doing deep work and more thoughtful, impactful work.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. I completely agree. I know David and I talk about in our roles the importance of protecting time for us to have deep work, thinking time to work on strategic issues. But it does apply to any role in the organization, and that gets to that balance between sync and async also too. I think in the past, in particular, agile consultants, myself included in the past, would say, well, you have to do everything synchronously. You have to do everything in person and shared office space and all that sort of thing. That mindset has definitely changed. But going to the other end of saying, well, everything should be asynchronous is not the right way either. So finding that right balance of the me time, the we time, the deep work and the shallow work, I think is really important and needs to be done per team. So, all right. Well, Gustavo, thank you again for taking the time to speak with us. It's been a really wonderful conversation. Again, really enjoyed your book. Thank you for writing that. Any closing thoughts you want to share, or how can our listeners learn more about you or get in touch with you about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. People can get in touch. I mean, on LinkedIn, I'm very active there, and I'm the only Gustavo Razzetti with ZZTT, so that's easy to find me. They can also go to our website, fearlessculture.design. It's .design, not .com. And one thing that's important, we have a lot of over 600 articles on the website, free to access, with lots of tools. So if you're looking for new tools to increase psychological safety, have a blameless postmortem, you're going to find not only the tools, but also facilitation guides that you can access. And of course, if you need help with facilitation or consulting, we're here to help you. My last thought is, people always ask me, who owns culture? Even though the ultimate responsible for the culture of a company is the CEO, and if you're a team leader, you are the ultimate responsible for the culture of your team. Culture is co-owned and co-created. So if you want to design a successful culture, you need to invite people to the conversation. You need to co-create it with the people. That doesn't mean that you're going to be the last one to make decisions. This is not democratic, but it's co-created. And I think that's critical for people to remember. You cannot impose culture. Culture is the result of everything we do, what leaders promote, but also how people behave.
Oh, that's a wonderful closing thought. Thank you, Gustavo. That's a great action item for all of our listeners. Go ahead and invite someone to the conversation in your teams and your organizations. Invite them to a conversation on culture, and you'll see a lot of the you'll see some great benefits to improving the quality of your work and staying living and working in this remote but not distant world. So thank you so much for your time, Gustavo.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, David, for hosting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.